general government ways and means subcommittee, and we'll do a subcommittee of the subcommittee this morning as we begin. Good morning. This morning we're met to convene on House Bill 5023, the Office of the Governor, and Kelly Friels will start us out from Department of Administrative Services. Kelly, you know what the piggy bank is for. The American Cancer Society appreciates all the acronyms, or two bits apiece, and Representative Johnson already has bought several of them, so we'll just go ahead and start out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will pay at the end. I will be here the entire 2 hours, and so I'll probably be paying big dollars. We are going to start with the governor's budget first thing this morning. And with me is obviously Peter Bragdon with the governor's office, the governor's chief of staff. And the display you should have before you, you actually have four displays from budget management. The one I want you to look at has the office of the governor on it. 2003-05 governor's budget, office of the governor. And we least have one number two.
We got it.
Excellent. I'll go to the next. Starting on page two, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me start by saying this is Kelly Friels with the Department of Administrative Services for the record. The governor's budget on page two is an $8.3 million budget. The vast majority of that is from the general fund. If you compare it to the budget as of the fifth special session, it's about a 10% reduction. I think most important, if you look down in the positions, this budget supports 37 positions, 36.5 FTE. If you make a comparison of that position level to the close of session budget for 2001-03, you can see that this budget is down 10 positions. Seven of those positions were due to budget cuts. Two positions were limited duration and automatically leave at the end of a biennium, and the final one position was financed with federal ODOT dollars that were discontinuing. So 10 position loss in the budget. Moving to the slide three that describes the funding for the budget. Again, mostly general fund. About 12% of the budget is with other funds. Those other funds come from three primary sources. First is a DAS assessment through our Human Resource Division that finances two state agencies, that finances the affirmative action function of this office. And that's a little under $500,000. Also, there's another state agency assessment that finances the Minority Women and Emerging Small Business Program. And that's between $400,000 and $500,000 also. And then the last $30,000, a very small amount, is from the Department of Energy for the Energy Facilities Siting Council.
Kelly, which page are you on right now?
I am moving to page four right now, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you.
And this just gives you a brief synopsis of what happened this biennium as well as what's in the governor's budget. And the synopsis of this biennium is that this office took cuts in the second, third, and fifth special session. In crafting the budget for 03-05, we do continue all the cuts that took place in the second, third, and fifth special session. This budget does include a reorganization to reflect the priorities of Governor Kidzapper, Governor Kulongoski. I'm old.
That's going to cost more than a quarter, Dave. Okay.
Well, yeah, but I won't be paying you. I might be looking for another job, though, so I just might put the resume out. Finally, there are two policy packages here. Essentially, the two policy packages are asking for permission to get donated funds for a conference and also for training related to the Minority Women and Emerging Small Business Programs. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move to page five. I just have a pie chart there that describes the personal service supply and capital outlay. Again, This cost of this budget is primarily in personal services. Over three-quarters of the budget financed the...
What's the capital outlay in the governor's budget, Kelly?
The capital outlay historically, Mr. Chair, has been used for technology to upgrade their technology. Mr. Chair, I think reasonably, because of the budget cuts that have taken place, this biennium and planned cuts that are taking place next biennium, there probably be very little capital technology type expenditures. We'd probably need to use those for to shore up some of the other shortfalls in the budget. Moving to slide 6 and 7, essentially this just goes through the building blocks we went through to craft this budget. We started with a budget when you left town of $10.3 million total fund. And this may be a little bit confusing with some of the information that legislative fiscal has put out, because they also include the special purpose appropriations in their information. There was a $218,000 special purpose appropriation specifically for post-secondary education commission, House Bill 2015, that we don't include in our numbers, but they do in theirs. And those dollars were removed from the special purpose appropriation as part of the second special session. And then the next item, the legislative approved actions through April of 2002, essentially eliminated all the second special session cuts. There were no emergency board actions. We did do the common adjustment of roll-up of the 01-03 compensation changes. And package 110, we adjusted mass transit. 020, we eliminated the federal position that was one time as a result of lack of federal funds. 030, Mr. Chair, is just the same stuff we've already had. And this office reflects the same growth in state government service charges that we had in other agencies, where you'll notice that the vast majority of that growth was in tort liability charges, which went up about 400%. And I think when I was here, representing Patridge's committee, we talked a lot about tort liability and the growth in that, as well as the workers' comp cost increase. Package 081, third special session reductions as part of that, took a pro rata reduction as well as the cut to the governor's salary as well as all other elected officials. Moving to slide 8, package 090 was a large one where we eliminated as a pro rata reduction 5 position and cut services supplies substantially. Because that was late in this biennium, the cut was about $300,000 in 0103, but it translates into about a $1.4 million reduction in the 0305 budget. And then finally, the two policy packages. Again, one oh one is the governor's marketplace is requesting $30,000. The expectation is that this expenditure limitation will allow the office to solicit donated funds for a conference. And package 102, again, is to provide training. They're asking for $10,000 expenditure limitation, with the understanding they have to collect those monies. And finally, slide 9, no fee or revenue changes, no technical adjustments, but just a note, as the governor, Kulongoski, came out with his revised budget, he did a pro rata reduction to the governor's office, the legislature, and the judicial branch. And so the governor's office, if this cut was approved, would take an additional $200,000 approximately. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's a brief overview.
Thank you very much, Kelly. At some point, as we continue on testimony, I'd like to know more about the policy option packages 101 and 102, how those might compete in any way with the women's or other advocacy commissions that are trying to raise funds on the outside for their sponsorship of their programs as well. So
sure. We have Lydia Nunez here, who is with the office, can provide that information at a later point if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it'd be wonderful. Thank you very much. Peter?
Morning. Thanks for the opportunity to speak this morning. I'm going to be fairly brief. My name is Peter Bragdon. I'm Chief of Staff for Governor Kuligowski. I wanted to start out by saying what is probably goes without saying that my door is always open to anybody that wants to come up and including other members, to talk about the budget for the office or the operation of the office, frankly, and so I just reiterate that today. Kelly's already touched on the most important things in terms of the numbers. Obviously, like others, we're having to prioritize with the changes in the budget, which, well, an unpleasant thing, is probably a healthy thing for us to be doing, and we want to make sure that we're focusing the resources of the office where we get the maximum return on investment in achieving the things that we are trying to achieve. I'm not planning on walking through the different organizational charts. I'm glad to do that if you like. I think what's most notable about the reductions is the most significant change is probably in the area of natural resources, where Governor Kitzhaber had many more people than we have. We essentially have three policy advisors. At one point, I believe they were up to about 14, including support staff. So that's notable. Health and Human Services, we essentially have one person doing a job that was done by two or three, I think, before. And on education, our legal counsel also doubles as our higher ed advisor. So we've been consolidating and reducing. And as much as we would like to have more bodies to be working on things, frankly, I believe that we may be approaching natural resources in the correct way, not having too many people there, and that might not be where we would add back if we were to have additional money. I'm sorry.
Representative Patridge?
Peter, I don't know if you have the budget notebook that we have. I'm trying to reconcile. I was looking at your staffing and organizational pieces. I'm looking at page 3 and 4 of your presentation package, and then I'm looking at pages 45 and 46 of your... they're radically different.
3 and 4 is the 0103.
Oh, this is 0103.
Right.
Okay. Helps if I read. Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, as I was indicating, if we were to have more money, I'm not sure that we would add back to natural resources to the extent that it was. I think there are other priorities that we would probably set, although those are probably fairly important areas. Among the other things we've done in our priority setting is to eliminate payments to the National Governors Association and the Western Governors Association, as we're trying to put, again, the money where we're going to get the maximum return on investment. Our policy focus, if you look at the people who are in our office, is much, much more on job creation and essentially trying to increase the responsiveness of government. We're still covering the same main policy areas, but we have a lot of people who have experience in building businesses and working on economic opportunity issues. As a general office policy, one thing, of course, we're trying to do is build better bridges between our office and the legislature, between the state government and the people of Oregon, and also between state government and federal and local governments. The budget obviously presents challenges there, and it's something that I would just say for the record. We understand that that's the case, but things such as elimination of a plane or access to a plane for the governor's office makes it more difficult for us to get out to eastern Oregon or other parts of the state. So those are things that we're working on and trying to find other solutions, whether we can do that with private money or other things like that. Also, our support staff is probably, that's where a lot of the burden of the shorter staffing, I think, falls. And that's, so if we don't get back to people in a timely manner, feel free to call me, but the fault is partly with the staffing and the amount of staffing we can have. We do have some functional differences in our office. I wasn't in the last office, but I know there's some things that we've done differently and that we've tried to organize differently. I don't need to go into that, but I'm glad to if anybody would like to ask any questions about it. And that's really all I
have. Any questions of Mr. Bragdon? Representative Johnson?
Just a curiosity, Mr. Bragdon, what were the payments to the Western Governors Conference and the National Governors Conference?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, those were they're members of both of those conferences, and essentially it was the dues associated with being members.
I understand that. I'm okay. Trying to get a dollar amount.
Oh, I don't think we have the specific.
$6,000 a year for NGA and 30.
Did you get that?
$86,000 for the National
Nationals and $36,000 for the National Governors Association, and I will pay the fine later.
For Western. Thank you.
What's that? All right. Other questions, Representative Johnson?
No, thank you.
All right. Peter?
We're done.
We're done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
In the order of presentation, Mr. Chair, we're going to be moving away from the governor's office, and there were three units within the Department of Administrative Services that were postponed until this time due to the interest of time. The first one is the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, and Dr. Bruce Goldberg will be joining me at the table, I'm hoping, to discuss that specific office. And I'm going to be going through, again, the short budget presentation for the governor's 2003-05 budget. Again, this one should say Department of Administrative Services, Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. So if you all have that, I'm going to move again to page 2.
We'll catch up. We're quick studies, Kelly.
Excellent. You're probably ahead of me, Mr. Chair.
I don't think so.
Total fund budget the governor is proposing is about $3.2 million. You can see that about half of that is general fund, half is other funds. This office has a substantial reduction in budget. A portion of that's due to budget cuts. The larger portion of that is just due to the fact that a lot of their functions are related to contracts. They just don't anticipate to have as many contracts this next biennium. Moving to page 3, this just describes the funding again. General fund, about 49%. Other funds of 51%. Primarily, other funds have come in historically from Robert Wood Johnson grants from the federal government, and also there are dollars there for the Medicaid matching. And I don't know if folks are familiar with the process. You are, so I won't talk about the.
Kelly, can you tell? Can you let me know historically why this is in DAS as opposed to DHS or within the scope of the governor's office?
I think, Mr. Chair, that it's statutorily included in the Department
what
of Administrative
Services. What the history
Services.
Is behind that, or Dallas?
Go ahead, if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I think some of the history is that when the Oregon Health Plan was established, the legislature wanted this researcher oversight independent. They didn't want it closely connected with those that would be delivering the services, e.g., Department of Human Services, so they chose to put it with Administrative Services.
All right.
Mr. Chair, it's just like the Office of Economic Analysis. Wanting to put it where it was independent as possible. Moving to slide 4, essentially what this budget does is take the cuts that have taken place through the biennium as well as what we believe to be the most appropriate level of funding based on the contracts they expect to have, and that's what composes the governor's balanced budget. Moving to slide 5, you can see personal services make up 3/4 of the budget. They have office expenses related to the services and supplies. And then the special payments dollars, again, those are the dollars that go out to human services for matching federal funds and come back in as other funds.
Okay.
Moving to slide 6. These are essentially the same building blocks. Start with the legislative adopted budget of $3.7 million total funds. The legislative approved actions through April, essentially two actions. One, the November 2001 Emergency Board added dollars for the Robert Wood Johnson grants, also added some positions, and then there were some reductions as part of the second special session. Base roll-up, the same. It's a compensation changes. Moving to the last slide on page 7 or slide 7, all your essential packages, essentially adjusted mass transit. The package 020 took all the, actually, packages 020 and 050 adjust for
the removal of one-time expenses related to the Oregon Health Plan 2 waiver, remove some Robert Wood Johnson dollars, remove some health resources and services administration grants, and added back the cuts that were one-time in the O2O package, and then policy package 091 is essentially just the across-the-board reduction that took place in the fifth special session. I think with this budget, there are no additional policy packages. The office is still working with our office to determine what the appropriate level of other funds would be, and as soon as we get the appropriate level, we'll be working with Dallas, and potentially we'll have an adjustment to the other funds as a result of what we believe to be the expenditure pattern of this biennium, how many dollars might move into next biennium. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's the end of my presentation. If you have any questions.
I have a question. I'm trying to get a better handle on really what this office does, what it's produced, why we need, in light of the short budget, why we need to the office in the future.
Okay. I would like to give a short answer to that, and Dr. Goldberg will give a longer answer, and I guess this is for me being around for a while that I give this answer. We put a tremendous a number of state dollars into health care. And we have the people in the Department of Administrative Services and OMAP providing just their share of the entire market. But what this office has always done for me is to give me a larger perspective of what the whole healthcare system is doing and how we as state government interplay in that and some of the cost shifts that take place depending on what the policy issues are that the governor and the legislature perform.
Okay.
So it's been very helpful to me just for whatever that's worth, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Dr. Goldberg?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Bruce Goldberg. I'm the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research. And actually, I will address it in a little bit longer fashion, but we'll try and remain as brief as possible. The question you just asked, Mr. Chair, about the reason that the office exists and the functions we play. There's a presentation which hopefully you have copies of, which I can walk you through, that looks like this presentation to the Joint Ways and Means Committee on General Government. We've got some copies in the back. Okay. Great. The Office of Health Policy and Research was really created by statute. It provides two major functions. One is staffing for the statutorily mandated public bodies that exist, and the other is to provide the legislature and the governor healthcare-related data and analysis to support sound health policy and decision-making.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I apologize, Dr. Goldberg. May I stop you right there?
Sure.
When you say provide staffing for the statutory, who are those people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I will actually get to those in a second. Briefly, that's the Health Services Commission, the Health Resources Commission, the Oregon Health Council, the Governor's Task Force on Racial and Ethnic Health, and the Advisory Committee on Physician Credentialing. And I'll go through the functions of each of those in a moment.
Thank you.
The history, and that's actually the next slide, and I think that's, Mr. Chair, what you were wondering about. The office was established in 1993 as the Office of the Health Plan Administrator. It was established exactly as Kelly said, was to provide some policy oversight to the then-forming Oregon Health Plan. In 1995, the legislature eliminated what was at that point a separate state Office of Health Policy and transferred its duties into the Office of the Health Plan Administrator. In 1997, the legislature renamed the office to the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, and in 2001, we became the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. The office works towards its mission by, number one, most of our resources go to providing staff support to the public bodies, the Oregon Health Council, Health Services Commission, Health Resources Commission, Racial and Ethnic Task Force, and the Advisory Committee on Physician Credentialing.
Can we stop there?
Sure.
Can you tell me what the difference between what the Oregon Health Council does, the Health Services Commission, and the Health Resources Commission?
Sure. I've got some slides on that in a little bit, but I can go through that
now. Okay,
well,
then I will wait. I'll sit on my hands and bite my tongue.
Okay.
See, he's advising that's okay as a physician. I'm worried.
You shouldn't bite your tongue.
All right.
You, sitting on one's hands is always a good thing to do.
All right.
At least I've been...
Alien tip.
People say that the best way to keep me quiet is to have me sit on my hands. We carry out specific tasks assigned by the legislature and the governor and provide reports and analyses. The office works, and the way we've worked is we've provided oversight and continue to facilitate coordination of the various state-administered components of the Oregon Health Plan. There are several components to the Oregon Health Plan, the FEOP program, high-risk insurance pool, and other components that we help coordinate. We work closely with private and public sector organizations to help create the kind of health policy that not only supports the health plan, but healthcare in general in the state, maintain databases to inform health policy decision-making, provide a revised, prioritized list of conditions and treatments each biennium. As I've mentioned, we staff the statutorily established advisory bodies, and we conduct analyses and disseminate reports. The next page is our organizational chart, which is an administrator, and we have the commissions and bodies that are part of the organization. We have a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant that is working towards evaluating the current Oregon Health Plan and the effects of the recent series of waivers.
Representative Johnson.
I just want to make a quick note. Given that the character of the health plan may change dramatically, what effect will that have on the Robert Wood Johnson grant, and how much is the Robert Wood Johnson grant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, first question, what effect will it have? We've actually been in touch with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation about this. They're aware of the potential changes that are going on in the state. The purpose of the grant is to evaluate changes in the Oregon Health Plan, and they were specifically around evaluating the changes with our last waiver. Should we seek another waiver, and should the health plan change? The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is very interested in continuing to support evaluation of those changes, as they believe that what we do here in Oregon has policy implications, not just for the state, but nationally, and they're interested in continuing to support that. The grant, the total amount of grant dollars has been $1.5 million, of which we've been able to match some of that money.
Match how? With what kind of money?
We've been able to match it with Medicaid money, because part of what that grant helps us do is provide the sort of administrative evaluation of the Medicaid program. So it's been federal match from federal Medicaid dollars.
Thank you.
But you don't have any federal dollars, Medicaid money, in this upcoming budget year. So those Robert Wood Johnson grants are not spinning off, or is it?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kelly Friels, you don't see the federal dollars because they take general fund, they ship it to Human Services. Human Services matches it dollar for dollar with federal funds, and it comes back as other funds. So you never see the federal funds that are in there.
But why in 99, 01, 01, 03, and 03, I mean, in L-103, we show substantial amounts of federal funds in this agency, and then we don't show any in the upcoming year.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe those were federal Medicaid dollars. I think those were
federal grant dollars.
I can answer that, Mr. Chair. In 9901, a federal grant was received directly to the given directly to the office, okay, and it carried over into 103.
All right. Thank you for explaining the flow of funds.
The next slide is current responsibilities and activities, and this gets directly at the question that was asked about the public bodies and commissions. The Health Services Commission, number one, this is the public body that prioritizes our list of services, the diagnostic and treatment pairs, the prioritized list for the Oregon Health Plan. This is a body made up of both health professionals as well as lay individuals who are responsible for the prioritization and management of that list. The Health Resources Commission is a body that encourages rational and appropriate allocation of medical technology in Oregon. Currently, the major task that the Health Resources Commission is doing is they were charged by the legislature under Senate Bill 819 to focus on the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan, and that's the body that is undertaking the evidence-based reviews.
I have a question then. I'm trying to understand to some degree the difference in work between the Health Services Commission and the Health Resources
Sure.
Commission, and why there hasn't been a lot of change, at least to my knowledge, on the health plan in terms of the list and some of those kinds of things. I mean, within the categories, of course, we've got to watch the money and how much is right. being spent, but I'm wondering what the necessity is for these two separate commissions and the five
Three.
Staff. Huh?
Three. We still haven't talked about the council.
I understand we still haven't talked about the council, but these are on one page, so I figure we go through.
Sure. There actually has been movement in the list of prioritized healthcare services. Medical care and technology changes, and the results of those changes actually require changes in movements of diagnostic and treatment pairs on the list. Things that, for instance, 3 or 4 years ago did not have effective treatments currently do have effective treatments. And the Health Services Commission actually meets regularly to evaluate exactly those issues. The other issue that they've been charged with this past session has been prioritizing not just the lines, the diagnoses, and treatment pairs, but they undertook a major emphasis in, I believe it was House Bill 2519, to prioritize healthcare services. When we submitted our recent waiver under the Oregon Health Plan, at that point it required a 25% reduction, more or less, in the amount of services being provided to the OHP standard population. The Health Services Commission is the group that actually went through and prioritized which services would be included and which services would be actually excluded from coverage for the standard population. So they've actually been an extremely busy group that has worked hard over the past several years, and as we see changes in the Oregon Health Plan coming up, we anticipate that likewise this will be a group that will hopefully be able to help us look at not only prioritizing services on the list, as we say, vertically, ranking them 1 to 700, but really looking at the ability of the Health Services Commission to begin to be certain that we only approve those conditions that provide the most cost-effective care. That's something that the Health Services Commission has not historically done, and one that there's certainly been great interest in over the last several months with the legislative committees that I've been working with on seeing that we begin to look at the appropriateness of services that are quote-unquote above the line.
And so how do you distinguish that between what the Health Resources
Commission? The Health Resources Commission now is focusing totally on pharmaceuticals and what they are doing.
But prior to pharmaceuticals, what did they do?
Prior to pharmaceuticals, what they did was primarily evaluate new technologies.
Okay.
Certificate
of need, and they looked at new technologies.
So if we eliminate the Certificate of Need, we can get rid of the Health Resources Commission?
No, I think, actually, right now, it would. If we eliminated the Health Resources Commission, we would be, in essence, eliminating the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan. That body now spends its entire time doing that function as charged by the legislature.
How many times a year does each of these commissions meet?
Well, the Health Services Commission meets every 1 to 2 months. The Health Resources Commission meets as a body, the Health Resources Commission meets every 2 months. It has subcommittees that are meeting almost weekly. There are meetings from some of the subcommittees that are looking at these drug classes. It's actually extremely labor-intensive work.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible, before we go to a work session, to have a list of who the members are on all
sure.
of these?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we'd be happy to. I can't give you the names off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to supply you with that.
Thank you. On all of them?
Sure.
Thank you.
The next page is the Advisory Committee on Physician Credentialing. This is a group, actually, that meets very infrequently and that we staff as part of other duties in the office. It has helped the state put together uniform physician credentialing for hospitals and health plans, has dramatically decreased the amount of administrative and bureaucratic efforts that go into those functions. We have the Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative. This is not a public, a statutorily created body. This is actually created out of the Robert Wood Johnson grant to evaluate recent changes in the Oregon Health Plan. The Oregon Health Council has been a policy oversight body that identifies and analyzes significant healthcare issues and makes policy recommendations. They're currently focusing on ways to improve access and improve health system efficiencies.
So can we go back to Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative
sure.
and Oregon Health Council?
Yes.
And can you distinguish each of those bodies from each other, as well as the Health Services Commission and Health Resources Commission?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, the Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative is the group that, this is not a statutorily created body. This is a group within our office that is funded solely as part of the Robert Wood Johnson grant funds to evaluate the recent changes in the Oregon Health Plan.
So you have seven people working on changes in the Oregon Health Plan and how to prioritize. That's how I read it. You have your Health Services Commission from your org chart, which has three people, and you have Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant, which has another four people. So that's seven people working on changes in the Oregon Health Plan.
Mr. Chair, the Health Services Committee works on prioritizing the list. The Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative isn't for people who actually are looking at changes in the Oregon Health Plan.
But doesn't changing the list change the plan? So functionally, otherwise the plan's static. I mean, they can be gathering data, general data, I suppose.
Mr. Chair, the Health Services Commission does not deal in the broader changes in the Oregon Health Plan, such as who is covered. What they're dealing with is merely managing the prioritized list of services, which is one piece of the Oregon Health Plan.
Then my question is, if they're not looking at who's covered, then what good does it do to have them prioritize up and down the list? I mean, it seems like the two are required to go hand in hand if we're looking at provisioning Oregon Health Plan services. So I'm trying to get a clear distinction between what each of the groups do.
The Health Services Commission, there has not been a group that has been statutorily charged with looking at what populations to cover. That has been a function that has not been statutorily designated. So the Oregon Health Council does help advise the state as to who to cover as part of its charge as an overall health policy advisory group.
But what good does it do to move the lines all around if we don't even know who's being affected by those lines and the efficacy of our whatever policies that we're setting? I mean, you can't do it in a vacuum. The Health Services Commission, I would hope, is not doing it in a vacuum. So I'm trying to understand where we're at.
Mr. Chair, the Health Services Commission does not do this in a vacuum. It looks at prioritizing the list of health care services, which it then would apply to any population that's covered. It tries to take the list and focus on the types of services and rank them and look at the diagnosis and treatment pairs, which can then be applied to any group that's covered under the Oregon Health Plan. The prioritized list of services actually stands as a piece of the Oregon Health Plan, which can be applied to whatever group is covered by the Oregon Health Plan.
And where are they receiving their information? From OMAP?
No, they actually, Mr. Chair, that group takes public testimony. That group is a group of physicians and lay individuals. They evaluate technical and medical research. They get funding and financial information from OMAP's actuaries. They take public testimony. And that's how they come to their decisions.
And that being the Health Services Commission?
That being the Health Services Commission.
So the Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative, what information does that provide to the Health Services Commission? Nothing?
Currently, the Health Services Commission actually does look at takes into consideration effects and changes of the Oregon Health Plan. When they have looked at, for instance, most recently benefit design and looking at the effects of copays, they would take into account some of the findings from the collaborative. The collaborative has just been is newly founded and has not been, over the last several years, something that's been in existence. As I had mentioned, it's part of the Robert Wood Johnson funding grant.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was it a requirement of the Robert Wood Johnson grant to form such a group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, no. This was an attempt actually to begin to leverage community resources by forming such a group. What this group has done is it's helped bring in other researchers and evaluators from the community, from places like Providence Health System, Oregon Health Sciences University, to help bring the degree of scientific information, knowledge, and experience to help this group evaluate the Oregon Health Plan.
I would just appreciate it if you could provide us a mapping of information. If I want to make a change in the Oregon Health Plan or general state policy, who has input to it? Who makes the final recommendation? I'm not sure with all of this out there that I have a good handle on it. You have a lot of staff looking at health policy decision making, and I don't even know how much input they've had on here. I don't know if Senator Winters is here, and I don't know how much input each of the four or five groups have had on the radical changes that have that are occurring now, as well as what OMAP does in reference to all four of these particular groups and the 19 plus staff in this particular organization. So,
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Winters.
Just another side question, because does the Office of Oregon Health Policy Research go beyond just the Oregon Health Plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the Office of Oregon Health Policy helps try and work with others in the state around establishing sound health policy that, yes, indeed, goes beyond just the Oregon Health Plan.
Because I had raised this concern. We have so much emphasis on the Oregon Health Plan that in Oregon we really haven't looked at the broader issue of a health delivery system in Oregon. And I have had some conversation with Dr. Goldberg and wanted to know if the Oregon Health Policy Office, you know, is getting into some of the broader context of that particular question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think that one of the things that the certainly several of the legislative committees dealing with the Oregon Health Plan now have come to understand is that the Oregon Health Plan doesn't exist in isolation. It exists as part of a greater healthcare system, and that many of the issues that are plaguing the Oregon Health Plan, which are primarily increasing costs of health care and issues with the delivery system and issues of access to health care, are issues that come before and affect the rest of the health care delivery system as a whole. So as we look at how we are able to provide cost-effective access to care, these issues need to be looked at from the perspective of the entire healthcare system, because certainly what's happening in Medicare, private health insurance, these issues are also affecting the Oregon Health Plan.
Is there duplication, though, between the Health Resources Commission and the Health Services Commission?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we've just been discussing that. The Health Services Commission primary function is to prioritize services on the list, and as you know, we have discussed several times, the task before the group coming forward is to look at ways we can actually create a more cost-effective list of services, and I know that you've been very interested in that. The major function of the Health Resources Commission currently is they've been charged as part of Senate Bill 819 to look at the physician-managed prescription drug plan. And what they spend their time and effort right now is on going through each of those drug classes and establishing the drug list.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. A couple of questions, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Fair, would it be possible to get a separate run for the remuneration of all of these positions? I think this money comes through Davis, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes.
I didn't see it in the book. Because it's in DAS, is it not?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have it back here.
Okay. And then secondly, is the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research a prerequisite to the Robert Wood Johnson grant, or could that grant be administered someplace else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that grant could be administered someplace else. It's not a prerequisite, although we are we're the current grantee. So that would take a discussion with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to change, actually, the grantee.
And how far are you through the grant?
We are about halfway through the grant.
Okay, with the possibility of a renewal, or when the grant's done, the grant's done?
There's, if Robert Wood Johnson were to continue funding, there would be a possibility of a renewal.
And last question, Dr. Goldberg. If the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research didn't exist, is there a place where the critical data could be analyzed within DHS or someplace else?
If the, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, if the or if the office didn't exist, that function would have to be taken up some other place. Exactly where that would be, I don't know. Certainly something could be created elsewhere, but it would be a function that would need to be taken up someplace else.
Thank you.
Dallas has it within the DAS binder, is my understanding, because that's where that's been. Representative Patrick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just really uncomfortable with where we're at with all the overlapping commissions and functions. And before I'd be prepared to vote on this particular piece of the budget, I'd really like to see, based upon their org chart and their staffing, what the primary duties are by a percentage as to what their staff does. I don't understand. I still don't have a clear understanding of the duplication between the perceived duplication that I have between kind of at least four of these particular groups that the office services. And in addition to that, Dr. Goldberg, I think, has tried to answer our questions, but I think we could stay here a while. I probably still wouldn't understand, and so I'm happy to meet with him. But I know there's a function on cost effectiveness that these groups are looking at, but I'm also interested if any of these groups have continued to look at the sustainability based upon our current revenue stream in Oregon, as well as the effects on the system as a whole. You know, I sat on the Human Services Subcommittee last time. I don't recall a lot of, I recall you being there, but not on a lot of occasions to where we heard from the various commissions. And so I'm concerned with if this is supposed to be the kind of global policy arm that's looking at effects on the system that as you're fond of saying, and I'm fond of quoting you these days, that water's not getting to the end of the row in terms of creating the knowledge within the legislature about the future sustainability of whatever healthcare delivery system we have as a state, including, you know, trauma and emergency room and all those kinds of things. Those issues have only recently kind of peaked as a result of the healthcare system. I'm concerned that those are issues where having 19 people who are certified smart people in the area, that those issues weren't noodled out and brought to the front, and maybe they were, they just didn't make it to my desk. And I'm concerned about the sustainability of the system. You know, we talked a little bit about roll-up costs in Senator Winter's committee when she chaired it on the House side last time. So I just continue to be concerned, and maybe the legislature hasn't utilized this office as much as it probably could too, but this is a heck of a lot of staff for overall and overarching healthcare policy that really I haven't heard a lot from, frankly, and you know, at least to the best of my knowledge. And maybe what's been prepared has been presented by other people. I don't know.
Dr. Goldberg?
Chair, Representative Patridge, I've been the administrator of the office for 2 months. I think that I have spent the vast majority of my time actually working directly with the legislature and informing the legislature about issues, particularly working with Representative Westland's House committee. And have been working very closely with Representative Westland, as well as working with Representative Cruz and some of the issues in his committee, and working with Senator Winters and many of the issues there. Our office is here as a resource to the legislature, and actually it's one of my issues in the office is actually to have the office be more available and more accessible to the legislature and providing what I believe is the type of information that's needed to inform health decisions. I actually would welcome the types of requests and for information that have begun to come to be able to do that, because I believe that that's how we all work together to formulate the best health policy.
Happy follow-up.
So I'm going to give you an open-ended question. You can respond as to the nature of what you feel. You can respond as someone who works in the executive branch under the particular infrastructure. How long? You've only been with the office 2 months.
Yes.
And prior to that, you were...
Chair Butler, Representative Partridge, prior to my taking this position, actually I came to Oregon in 1991, was to Oregon Health Sciences University, was health officer for Columbia County, and met Representative Johnson years ago. I then spent the last 6 years as medical director for Oregon, the largest Oregon health plan. I've been basically for the last 10 years here in Oregon involved in how to in health policy issues, how to best organize and develop health policy. That's where I've come from. So I've come from a world of trying to figure out how to take what's become a huge part of our state expenditure as well as 14% of our gross national product and be able to take with that and get the kind of benefit from those dollars that our citizens deserve.
So I guess my question is, based upon your knowledge and experience and outside view of the system, is the commission structure that we have that your office has been put together to report on, is this a way we should be organizing our health policy in the state and the advisory commissions in our state, or is there a more streamlined approach that is more pointed and poignant? You didn't sit around in CARE Oregon. I'm sure you didn't sit around with having meetings every other month surrounding the efficacy of a particular prescription drug plan, but to some degree you probably did, but not to the same degree in the public policy manner. But that's an open-ended question as to how you would tailor what your office does versus the responsibilities that is currently statutorily assigned to do. Because obviously this committee you've seen expresses some concern over how it is, and you're now the new director.
Thank you. Chair Butler, Representative Partridge, I'm actually happy to address that question. I think it's, it's at the crux of what my office does. It's also at the crux of how we develop the best and most rational health policy in the state. The commissions themselves, and I would say that right now the Health Services Commission, quite frankly, plays an extremely important role, and I would continue it. In fact, I would look at, and I've spoken with many members of the legislature about ways actually the Health Services Commission has to actually step things up a notch. What's unique about Oregon, let me back up for a second, is I think what's unique about Oregon and the Oregon Health Plan, and I think has allowed us to do many of the things that we've done here, has been actually the fact that many of these decisions are made publicly by public bodies, and that public process of prioritizing what we're going to cover and what not has been a process that I think has allowed much of the state to resonate with the decisions that have been made. Having said that and having created what I believe has been ways that health policy has been informed by the public, let's take them one by one. The Health Services Commission, I believe that we have a list of prioritized healthcare services, and you mentioned, and I agree with it. Well, why do we need these people to tinker with moving something from 522 to 526 or line 500 to 518? I'm actually not sure that we need that, but I can tell you what we do need. And what we do need is we need a group of individuals to be able to look at each of those lines and be certain that what's being paid for to treat those conditions is actually the most cost-effective care that we have. And we haven't done that. The last 10 years, the Health Services Commission has been looking at ranking things up and down.
You're writing the stamps, Senator Winters? You wrote that last quote?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I've had this very discussion with Senator Winters on several occasions, and I believe we've got to look at how we can be certain that what's being paid for on each of those lines is actually gets us what we want and gets us cost-effective treatment. So I actually think the Health Services Commission is vitally needed. I think it actually needs to evolve into a greater role. Let's now move to the Health Resources Commission. The Health Resources Commission, as it is currently charged through Senate Bill 819, is looking at the prescription-managed drug, the practitioner-managed drug list. It's actually a full-time job. That's a job that if that were to go someplace else, I don't know where, and then I do actually believe that many of the functions of looking at cost effectiveness of treatments and what we pay for could actually be combined. Right now, as it's structured, the work of the HRC and the work of the HSC actually couldn't be done by one group of volunteers because, quite frankly, the volunteers that we've solicited from around the state have been taxed. Our abilities to get physicians from the four corners of the state and volunteers from around the four corners of the state to sit on these commissions, sometimes it gets problematic. And if we were to put all those functions together and ask the same group to do that, that'd be very difficult. Also, many of the staffing issues regarding looking at prescription drug issues versus looking at the cost effectiveness of treatments, I think we can, I would be very happy to look at how we organize and restructure. I think that needs to be a careful conversation about the directions we as a state want to go and the types of advice and input that we need. I'd actually love to talk and be involved in those conversations with the legislature. Right now the conversations have been and the work have been around sort of the nuts and bolts and day-to-day of how do we create for the next couple months, how do we put together an Oregon health plan for the next couple of years. I think actually we've got to be looking at how we deliver services to our citizens, not just over the next 2 years, but over the next decade. And I'm not prepared to give you a blueprint for that right now. I am prepared to sit with you and anyone else to talk about how we do that and what that structure is.
We'll take the time out of Representative or Senator Winters' committee to go ahead and develop the health plan. But right now we need to develop a budget the department. Senator Winters?
Just to piggyback, because I've had this conversation, because we have concentrated so much over the past 10 years or so on one segment of the population in Oregon that we have not done the bigger picture, and that is to actually look at public policy that focuses on Oregon health, the care of Oregonians, period, in the healthcare scene, theme, and it's interesting to me, and I'm glad that you brought it up, because I do think you're narrowly focused. I do think and that there is some combining, but I also think that maybe the public policies, we talk about the broader picture, and that is the total health care and what does Oregon want its health care to look like. That's a policy question, but I couldn't agree with you more.
Representative Patridge?
But I guess that even amplifies my concern. From my vantage point, I agree that that we have created a health system and got buy-in because we have shown the light of day on some of the decisions that are made. But I guess my concern is how much of the staff work is being done at OMAP and through DHS in regards to proper treatments, proper drug use, proper plan, as well as the treatments for particular line items and the cost effectiveness. And I guess my concern is, what does your staff do compared to what the OMAP staff does, and then the actual burden that we put on the commission. I mean, I view a lot of that, as someone who's served on several boards and commissions, as a lot of it is more staff work and the boards and commissions arriving at a particular decision where there's public buy-in and public accountability, where people could, if they want to raise a concern, can do that. And I'm still not understanding the distinction between the five staff people who serve these particular commissions versus the multiplicity of staff people that Representative Winters is dealing with I guess down the hall in the afternoon with her committee. So until I get a distinction between what your staff is recommending to these versus what Senator Winter's staff that she's dealing with in DHS have in the overall decision, I don't have a comfort level. So I'm prepared to go on, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
But I do need
to have that conversation.
I sense that there's a significant amount of uneasiness in the process. We've had 19 people here in the past who've done various items, so we need to bring some conclusion to what it is that you'll be doing with the budget resource that's being requested here. I would like to have just one brief additional conversation about something that Senator Johnson or Representative Johnson asked, and that's with regard to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So you're about halfway through that grant. What's the size of that grant?
I believe that grant was $1.5 million.
Okay, $1.5 million, and you're about $750,000 into that then. So that matched with the Department of Human Services resource, excuse me, and then some other fund. What is the other fund at that point? There's some general fund. Just in other funds. That appears to be FN and other funds.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kelly Creels.
Kelly?
I think it's probably best for us to take the $1.6 million of other funds, and then let's break that down.
Okay,
grant, how much of that is Medicaid dollars, how
and then, from other let's figure out where we're at on that process.
Works.
Are there further questions relative to the Office of Health Policy and Research? Seeing none, let's go on to the community office, community development office. Thank you very much, Dr. Goldberg. Let Chris Warner come up.
Mr. Chair, let me start with the budget presentation, and this is the BAM handout entitled Department of Administrative Services Community Development Office. Here we spend the majority of the time with Chris.
Do you have a copy of that?
I do. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay. We'll have copies of that. Let me start again with the second page. Again, this budget is about $1.7 million. It's all financed with general fund. Seven positions, and the cuts in fifth special sessions about 15%. Moving to page 4. It's interesting, I go from page 2 to page 4. Page 4 just describes real briefly what the 14% does. Essentially,
14% removes about $300,000 from the dispute resolution activities, as well as the cuts that took place in the fifth special session. If you move to page 5, you can see the services and supplies makes up about a quarter of the budget. Personal services for the seven staff make about 25%, roughly. Going through the building blocks of the budget on page 6, again, the budget starts with about a $2.1 million total fund budget. There were some one-time administrative savings that were identified in the second special session that were cut and then restored in the package 020. In the base budget adjustments, again, we just adjusted the compensation. And in the 030, we adjusted the state government service charge as well as the inflationary amounts. And again, Mr. Chair, it's the same two components that make up the majority of the growth on the state government service charges. And on page 7.
That's page 6 on our handout.
I'm sorry, page 6. Just a little bit
different, yeah.
Page 6, okay. Maybe I got an earlier version. And then we go to the policy packages, package 090. Essentially, all we're doing there is eliminating the dispute resolution commission dollars of, I think, around a little under $300,000. And just for your own edification, these were dollars that were put into an in-session bill in 2001. The easiest place to put them in, because this is the only one of the budgets that was open, was to put the dollars in here. And essentially, we put them in here, and then we took them out as part of the reductions for the, I think, was that the second special session, Dallas, or the third special session, one of those?
Who was keeping track?
Yeah, one of the special sessions. And then package 091, again, just makes the cuts to the pro rata reductions that took place. There's actually two cuts that took place in this office. There was a specific reduction and then a pro rata reduction. And finally, this office structure is the Chris will talk about this. There is an expectation that they would like to change the structure. They did have originally four regional reps. With the budget cut, they only are down to three in their budget, and Chris has a plan to, within the same number of dollars, continue to have four staff to be out into back out into the local communities. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's the brief overview. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Fields? Please proceed. Chris, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Chris Warner, the Director of the Community Solutions Office for the Governor. You'll see I have a quick PowerPoint presentation that is on paper and not in PowerPoint, so you can take a look at that. The mission of the Community Solutions Office is to streamline the delivery and improve the quality of state community development services to local partners and to work with local partners on high-priority opportunities and challenges. Program overview for the Community Solutions Office. We basically advocate and deliver increased coordination among state agencies, as you can see, and the Community Solutions Office also has an infrastructure of locally based collaborative problem-solving people and a network-based organizational structure that basically helps to achieve these purposes. In these difficult economic times and budgetary times that you're more aware of than anyone else, certainly business as usual is no longer an option for state government, and that's certainly a message that we've received from the governor's office and also from the legislature. It's a message that basically drives the work of the Community Solutions Office and our Community Solutions team agencies, and those seven agencies are Oregon Economic Development, Department of Transportation, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, Department of Environmental Quality, Oregon Housing and Community Services, and recently we have also added the Division of State Lands and the Oregon Department of Agriculture to work as Community Solutions Team agencies. The Community Solutions Office and the Community Solutions teams have really created this infrastructure that helps, you know, deliver more efficiency for people that are actually accessing state government and also for our local partners. The next slide is kind of a graphic representation, the one that says before Community Solutions, that talks about state government before Community Solutions. If you had a local jurisdiction or official that try to navigate through the state agencies. You certainly had them going from one agency to the next without a lot of efficiency. It certainly was slower for them, frustrating. There was a lot of duplicity. It was duplicative. How's that?
The other is an operative word, too.
You'll have to. I apologize for that. I'm going to speak, Representative Johnson. But with Community Solutions, we've tried to kind of change the paradigm of how we operate state government, where you have your local problems or your local groups, and they work with our 10 regional Community Solutions teams. Out in the field to actually increase the efficiency of state government, making it more timely, more cost-effective. What I'd like to do right now is quickly to kind of give you a better idea of how these work. Some projects that we've worked on in the past that have been, you know, very successful in terms of not only saving the state money but also saving our local partners money, because, you know, as our state budget has been hit by many of the things that are happening out there, the local governments are also suffering as well. So certainly one example is in Millersburg and Albany will now have a joint water system rather than two separate ones. The Community Solutions team was critical in helping these two cities successfully navigate the state and federal permitting maze, and it basically saved millions of dollars for the taxpayers, not only of Oregon, but for the local jurisdictions in Linn County. Prineville will soon have a cleaned-up brownfield in its downtown as a centerpiece of its city government campus project. The project will keep the business district downtown vital by keeping the city, state, and county workers all downtown, and that's really helpful in a lot of those smaller communities. This brownfield will become a civic plaza in front of the historic Crook County Courthouse. And the plaza will also, through the work of the Community Solutions Office, will also double as a floodway mitigation project for the nearby Ochoco Creek. So we basically have been able to leverage not only all the state agencies, but we brought the Federal Emergency Management, the FEMA people, into the project as well. And it also, the City of Prineville and Crook County, to have another successful project where we not only, you know, streamline some of the regulation, but we also save the state money ultimately. In Central Oregon, permitting for the Klondike Wind Farm in Sherman County took just 4 months, and that was basically a Community Solutions team project where we brought all the players to the table, and by doing that, we were able to, you know, avoid lawsuits, avoid, you know, we brought some of the wildlife agencies on board so they could actually get on board early on, so we don't have kind of the starting and stopping when you get all the things with one agency, then you go to the next. We actually bring them all together, and we were able to create an economic benefit in Sherman County and also a renewable energy project that I think is going to benefit the whole state. One other success story that I'll talk about quickly is the work we did in Lakeview with the paving of Highway 395. Generally, ODOT and the Department of Transportation would go in and in many of these small towns, the main street is actually the state highway. And so when they would go into the small town, they would, you know, just do a paving project. By bringing all the other state agencies together, we were able to kind of create a model project where they did a lot of street improvements for Lakeview and made the downtown much more viable. And we've been able to replicate kind of that process we went through in Lakeview in places like Forest Grove, Morrill, Gold Hill, and Nissa. So that's one of the things that we've been working on. The next map you'll see is a map of the Community Solutions team's regions. As I mentioned before, we have 10 regions, 2 in eastern Oregon, 3 in kind of the central corridor, 2 in the northwest corner, 1 here in the mid-valley and the coast, and then 2 in southern Oregon. These 10 regional teams, it's basically been said, put windows in the agency silos. The state needs the specialized knowledge that resides in these agencies, but sometimes this specialization creates these, you've heard it more than I have, these silos of knowledge that runs very deep but often isn't very wide. And so by having an interagency coordination effort by the Community Solutions Office, we're able to break down some of these barriers and make the state agencies actually work more closely together and have better results for the state and for the taxpayers.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, looking at these 10 regional teams, it has been my experience, and I haven't been a tiny bit shy about saying it, that one of the things that makes CS, the Community Solutions team, work so well is the people and the relationships that they're able to form at the local level. With four regional people now, three depending on how your idea matures, tell me how they're going to service the 10 regions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, and that's one of the things we're examining. Certainly, the way I look at it is certainly the eastern and central regions, I think we're going to keep basically the same representation as well as southern Oregon. The way we're looking at doing some of the, I guess, changes would be what happens basically in the Mid-Valley. And I think what's going to happen is I'm going to basically pick up much of the Mid-Valley work, and Robin from our Portland office will kind of tag team, and we'll also, we have the central core function in Salem. So instead of having a field rep which actually covered basically the Mid-Valley and the coast, I'll be doing much of that function, and Robin will be helping me tag team that as well as Gabrielle and the other support person in our office. So we brought the in terms of if I would have had somebody in eastern Oregon, it's harder for me from Salem to actually try to cover that. So I will probably be covering part of the field myself.
Okay, so follow up. Mr. Chair. So in central Oregon, you've got Mary Sue Carlson.
Correct.
Eastern, you've got?
Sherry Davis.
Okay. And Jackson Josephine down in that?
Jackson Josephine plus Coos Curry and Douglas is Jeff Griffin in our Medford office.
Okay. And then you would be Central Valley.
Yes, correct.
And that would leave Northwest Oregon, the metro area, out to the Dalles?
To Hood River.
Out to Hood River.
Yeah.
That would be
Robert's
territory. Okay.
Who's that? Robin?
Robin Roberts.
Robin Roberts.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
I just have a question while we're there at that particular point. Looking at your organization chart, Chris, for 2003-2005, we've got a group of lone liaisons. Do those lone liaisons work throughout the state, or do they work with your coordinators in each of those places? And what happens when I have a DLCD lone liaison that I need to have them work with Mary Sue Carlson, Sherry Davis, and Robin Roberts all at the same time?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I will talk a little bit about the chart. As you can see from the 2003-2005 organization chart, I think that's on page
4 on the handout.
This is the one that if it were in smaller type, Mr. Chair, would disappear.
I saw you working away at it, Representative Johnson, and I figured once you get it interpreted, maybe share it with all of us.
That was the chart as it was originally proposed before I got here. Actually, what we would like to do on the next page is kind of the proposed chart that Kelly referred to. But I would like to talk a little bit about the lone liaisons. In the past, not only did we have the Central Corps here in Salem, but each of the state agencies sent a lone liaison that actually continued to do most of their work for their agency, but they were housed within the Community Solutions Office here in Salem. And that was to kind of foster the relationship between the agencies and have someone there. During the series of budget reductions during the special sessions, those folks actually went back to their original agencies. So we still do have liaisons that work with each of the individual agencies, and they serve basically as kind of a point of communication. If you're not able to get a hold of the director, I call my liaison and say, you know, I need to talk to Bruce or whomever the director is. And so in our organization chart now, those actually no longer exist, though we still will have liaisons within each agency. Certainly, when Mary Sue thinks about in her central corridor an agency liaison, she will go to the folks in her regional community solutions team, which would be the field staff or DLCD in central or eastern Oregon. So Mary Sue would deal with those primarily, and the liaisons were more for the central office to work with the directors on those.
And not knowing who those people are, do we have confidence that, I mean, I guess we just take those directors of those agencies, whether it's the Division of Land Conservation or the Oregon Economic Development or Transportation, we're just going to take their word that they will send us people to work with the new and reconstituted Community Solutions team who have the ability to say yes to a project.
Mr. Chairman, that is my expectation, and the generally what happens is I meet with the potential candidates put forward by the agency heads to actually, you know, discuss, you know, what they would bring to the Community Solutions Office and what they can do to help forward our mission. Certainly, I've had very good experiences with the directors of the departments who were supportive of the program, and also with the liaisons have all been, in my quite limited experience, have all been, you know, very committed to the process.
Well, in my very limited experience, Chris, my concern is that these folks have a culture and a custom within their agencies that one agency won't move without another agency, and because there's some degree of, for lack of a better word, we'll call it inertia, that the culture has always been to just nobody moves. And again, in my limited experience, if we do not have people who are committed to say yes and move forward with projects, or to say no, that it's in violation of state law and nobody could ever go there without a change, a significant change in state law or some sort of rescission of the statutes, that's fine too. The folks just need to know it, as opposed to being able to or being directed that maybe they ought to have more resources. Maybe there ought to be a grant put together by someone else to see if they can overcome these various kinds of things. I think we've collected most of the low-hanging fruit. I've expressed that to the staff. And my concern is that last session we said we would go ahead and fund these particular Community Solutions Office, the CST, only based upon the ability for these folks to get projects done and to be able to say yes. And my concern is that the NISA project had some hang-ups. ODOT couldn't in and of itself, didn't have ability to go ahead and manage those issues. It took a legislator coming on board, a couple of them, a state senator as well as the member of the House, to come forward and say, listen, either you go ahead and listen to these local folks and proceed with the project based upon the local needs. At that particular point, as I recall, they had a rule, an access rule that fit for high-growth communities that didn't really seem to fit for a very slow-growth community like NISA, and we're just going to blow them off. And, it was the Community Solutions Team representative from Eastern Oregon for ODOT that told me, well, we just can't do that. Well, if that's the attitude that the folks come to the table with, we've got to change the culture. And, again, I've got a tremendous reservation. We've come 2 years with a cost of a few million dollars in this particular budget, and we still have this culture issue. The folks that want to say, no, I don't think we can do it. So that if you can help us overcome that and tell me how you're going to be able to overcome that, and I don't think a simple interview is going to do it, Chris, with the folks that are assigned to you. With that, I know that Representative Johnson has expressed some concerns with the folks in these projects, overcoming the projects by basically hanging flower baskets downtown. Sometimes that's nice, but it really may not be the best utilization of our resources. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I want to be very clear that my position on that is understood. I have been extremely reticent to support initiatives inside OECDD that do flower baskets, particularly at this juncture in our fiscal situation. That is not my experience with the Community Solutions Team. My experience with the Community Solutions Team has been very positive.
Good.
These are folks that have come into extremely difficult situations and have helped us find a way out of the woods in Clatsop, Columbia, and in Tillamook counties, although that's not my legislative district. They're working right now on trying to help ameliorate a problem with respect to Lewis and Clark. So I want to be.
Going to get them back home, are they?
Yeah.
One problem.
Yeah.
They're stuck in Clatsop County.
No, I want to be very clear that I have been critical, and I think justifiably critical of things that are taking public money right now and building desirable but unnecessary accoutrement to downtowns like restrooms and parks and things like that. That's not to say restrooms aren't critical at certain junctures, but my point is that these guys are problem solvers, and I think, at least in my district, they have a demonstrable record of doing exactly that. In my experience, they've come to the table as the let's get to yes guys, and they've had to beat down agencies periodically to shorten that distance between a good idea and a finished product.
Representative Johnson, let me just ask you to make sure so that Chris can make a commitment to us as we proceed forward here with the Community Solutions Team organization. My angst is that most of the low-hanging fruit has been fairly easily collected, and that for future opportunities, we need to make absolutely certain that these move forward with folks that can say yes. Do you feel, Chris, that there is still this issue continues to be one of the change of culture. Has the culture changed, you think, Chris, or can you get it to change?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, certainly I think that is the commitment, and I think the one thing that that makes me think that is there was a commitment by this governor to make sure that state government operates differently. And certainly that is the instructions that we have been given in terms of the work of the Community Solutions Office. As we go along further, much of the work that we did earlier was very project-oriented, working through some of the problems on the local level with a lot of community development emphasis. We are part, as the governor has identified, part of his economic recovery team, and part of that economic recovery is making sure the state agencies are responsible, they streamline the regulations, and they actually, work with local communities. Because I didn't come here in terms of when I came to join this administration to, further hanging fruit baskets in communities. Certainly we want to get results done, and we want to get things and this economy rolling, particularly in rural areas, is one of the emphasis that this governor has put on the work of Community Solutions. And part of it is that it's also part of capacity building. Certainly in many communities east of the mountains and even in southern Oregon and even some of the coastal places, we don't have a lot of capacity within those communities as far as technical expertise, and that's what our people are able to provide to those communities.
Chris, can you tell us what's happened to these lone liaisons that have been out there outstanding serving the Community Solutions teams in the past? Are they fitting back into their agencies, or are they are those vacant positions?
I think most of the work, my understanding, Mr. Chairman, is that the work of the lone liaisons, primarily they still did the functions for their agencies within the Salem office, and that's where the lone liaisons were. They were actually within the Salem office, and they were doing the community solutions work as a small part of their duty. And I think with a lot of the cuts that a lot of the agencies have had, they've gone back to doing primarily the duties that they had prescribed for them earlier. And I think that, for instance, the lone liaison we had for DLCD recently retired. So we're in the process of trying to find someone to work with that agency. The person that worked with us with Oregon Housing Community Services also does like some of the farm worker outreach things, so she had plenty on her plate as well. So the lone liaisons I saw as a smaller part of our operation, but it's more the actual people out in the field. And I'd love to talk to you about some of the experience you had out in NISA in terms of what happened in that region, and I would love to explore that, because it's certainly not the way this administration wants to do business.
Representative Johnson, or Representative Patrick, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize that I missed part of the original part of the presentation, and maybe this is ground that you've already plowed, so stop me if it certainly is. But sure. Representative Butler and I sat on the committee that looked into the Community Solutions Team beginning in 1999. The idea was that these people would have direct reporting authority within the bounds of the governor's office in order to streamline the process and get the attention. That has not occurred over the last 4 years. I'm concerned that we continue to maintain this program, as well as Representative Butler and I were promised that it would be funded predominantly with other funds, and it doesn't look like that is the case. Again, and so I guess my concern is we're creating additional staff within the bounds of these, really within these agencies that haven't occurred to streamline the process. I feel like they've picked a lot of low-hanging fruit in various areas that was going to ultimately
that was going to ultimately be solved because of political pressure and other things, but they're not initiating a lot of projects on their own. So that remains my concern. When they first came to the legislature with the community solutions idea, they didn't even have an organizational chart as to how these people would work. And I remember very vividly standing out in the hallway with Mr. Wolf and with Katie looking at the reporting structure on these. That reporting structure did not occur, has not occurred, and I probably won't be supportive at this time unless it's going to get, unless it will rise to the level that is high enough that actual change will occur. So that I don't disagree that they're not a good idea, but I think the way they're set up, they don't really accomplish a lot except provide more staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only comment that I can make in response to my colleague's observation is that I have been in meetings where the regular agency folks are there all with their cards that say ODOT or DLCD or whatever, and the Community Solutions team, by virtue of the fact that they carry cards with the imprimatur of the governor on them, tend to get through some of the debris that's around conversations about projects, conversations about recruitments, conversations around deals. The fact that they are seen as an extension of the governor's office cuts through a fair amount of clutter.
Mr. Chairman, I would love to have an additional discussion with you. I mean, we are part of the governor's office. I attend every one of the policy meetings of the governor. The governor has talked about us on the stump. He's put us in both the executive orders he's issued in terms of part of his office, and the work of the Community Solutions Office is a major part of this administration. So there is a reporting function to the governor. We report to the governor. The governor, asks what's going on. He is very active in the involvement in our office.
Representative Patridge?
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I guess my concern, though, continues to be what's Community Solutions done by running over the agencies at various levels to change the culture of the agencies. And, part of also what we were promised is that there would be some cultural fixes that would be identified as a result of having some of these Community Solutions team members out on the street. And I'm interested to know what initiatives and what changes have been made previously, and what this governor intends to do if he continues to want to do community solutions teams, what he intends to do with the information that you share with him at the policy level to change the very culture and nature of how we do business in state government. I'm not aware of anyone who's lost their jobs or anything else who've been impediments in the process and continue to be impediments in the process that have been identified by community solutions team members. I'm interested to know if that's happened.
Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say, since there's been so much of this conversation, that I support the work of the Community Solutions team. I think the question that needs to be asked, in a sense, is if the problem is that they are not actually affecting the culture of state agencies to the level that perhaps they should be. I think it's almost a given that if they weren't there in the first place, there would be probably no ability to affect those cultures of those agencies. So, I mean, if you question whether or not you're being successful, which I think is a good question, but we need to put more emphasis, because no one, I think, here is saying that you take them away. Because if you take them away, then you're either admitting that you can't affect that culture, or you're saying that that culture has went away and that those entities won't, there's no real problem out there.
Or you could be saying, we don't have enough resources to fight this game. We'll save our resources and come back and fight another day.
That's well, that you could be saying that, too.
Okay.
I mean, it's a sad commentary, I think, to the average citizen out there, because it seems akin to me, and I'm not being as clear as I should be, as a job my nephew once had, is that he's an executive with Chevron, and Chevron had created a number of nonprofits to basically do research for them on software needs for Chevron. And his official job at one time was to lobby the nonprofits that Chevron had created so that they would produce software that was what Chevron actually needed. But, I mean, it's a sad commentary with the chief executive who, the governor, and I'm not speaking solely about this chief executive, needs a separate branch to control his own agencies in terms of functioning in the direction he and the legislature would like them to function.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Petridge?
Mr. Chair, that's along the lines of part of the conversation I had with Katie and Greg Wolf during the last administration was, is this a temporary solution until we can change the agency culture? Because this is really how the agency should act in their culture. And I continue to remain concerned that we embed this as a way to get around what agencies do rather than seek a permanent shift in the culture within the agencies so that this is how they should treat everyone, not somebody who goes out and turns over the rock that has the community solutions team sitting underneath it with the weight of the bureaucracy on their head and shoulders. So, I'm looking for permanent solutions to changing the culture.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, I would agree. I mean, certainly, I would love it if there was no need for the work that we do. Because that means all the state agencies are playing well together, they're being responsive to the local communities, they've broken out of their silos, and, you know, everything is great. I just don't see it out there, quite frankly, and that's, you know, part of the work that the governor has charged us with doing. Someone just reminded me that that actually there, and I can bring this up, we can probably talk about any kind of certain personnel issue, but there have been field personnel that because of the work Community Solutions Office have been pulled out of the field. And because they weren't being responsive to the local communities, they have not, you know, been working well in facilitating either the cutting of regulation and the streamlining things. Certainly one of the things that we are working on is, and the governor's asked us to work on, is the industrial lands problem for the state. We are working with Economic Development, one of the lead agencies, in terms of the certification process that we're going through. Right now, the Community Solutions staff are out there working with the state agencies to get identified 25 sites for, you know, quote-unquote shovel-ready, project-ready, market-ready, one of the terms on working on that. And we are working with those state agencies to make sure that they get it done. And as part of Senate Bill 467, which I think is on its way to Ways and Means, there was work in there for the Community Solutions Office. And part of that is, to go back to what you said, there is a reporting function that part of the work of the Community Solutions Office is actually to issue a report that talks about changes to agencies state agencies need to make in terms of the way they do business. And so I think it's critically important, and I can't speak to Katie or Greg or folks that were here before me, but certainly that has got to be part of the mission of this organization, is to actually facilitate change, because if all you're doing is Band-Aids and there's no kind of more systemic change, then we're not doing our job right.
Senator Winters?
I guess I'm just a little perplexed since when I used to be on the governor's staff, and changing the culture of agencies wasn't quite that complex. And so I'm sitting here with this puzzled look on my face of saying, if you wanted shovel ready or you wanted an agency to respond directly from the governor and the impact of that office, usually meant that that's what you did. having been in working for two former governors, I'm just trying to figure out why you need a team of people to go in and to say to staff that you do your job.
This is a governor that's already raised teenagers, Senator, so we don't have to be challenged at every corner. Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, and there's some questions that have been asked. If you'd respond back through the committee staff, then let's come back and respond to those issues, if you would, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to rest and return so that we can get through the fourth item that we have here today. And Is Marty available?
Marty's right there.
Mr. Chair, given the interest of time, let me real briefly go through the budget. And we're joined by, from the governor's office, Marty Sapoff. And you should have the BAMP displayed, Department of Administrative Services, arrest and return, starting with the page 2. Again, the governor's budget for this office is just a little bit under $1 million, which is about a 3% reduction from the budget as of the fifth special session. This budget only has one staff, so if you move to page 3, you can see that the vast majority, again, is general fund, with just a small amount of other funds, primarily from restitution from offenders. On the next page, primary reductions in the budget to get to the 3%. There was a significant reduction in the fifth special session. This budget does assume that there's a reclassification of that one position based on job duties, and other than that, we're just maintaining the core services. Moving to the pie chart on page 5. Unlike most agencies that we've talked to about today, the predominant funds go to services and supply for the cost of the marshals. Over 20% go to capital outlay for the cost of the vans, and a very small percentage, 19%, relate to that one position. So on page 6, again, the building block, starting with a budget of $1.3 million. It's cut due to the second special session, and then those one-time cuts are added back in the roll-ups under the O2O package. We're doing the same compensation changes we've done before. The O3O compensation is the same, Mr. Chair. Package on page 7, package 082, identifies the reduction related to, and this agency actually took two reductions. One was a specific reduction in section 1 of the bill related to health to the fifth special session, which would limit the participation in the shuttle system, and then as part of the pro rata reduction, package 091. There was another cut of about 14%. And in that first bullet under package 091, it says $193,071 general fund was cut, and a reduction of one position. That's an error on my part. You should cross out that one position. That was actually another agency that we had that issue with. And then...
I think I may have done your budget irreparable when I got mixed up with another one.
Mr. Chair, this is when you're Sunday and you're looking at your presentation document and you say, oh my gosh,
that's a comment.
Where did this come from? Yeah, that's what I was thinking, the same thing. And then there is one package, and I alluded to it earlier, package 210, and that is reclassifying upward the current person in that office. And that's a result of a March 2001 inclusion of the interstate agreement on the detainees program being added to this program. And Mr. Chair, representing Patrick, I have no idea what those words mean. So you can ask someone else.
I do. Representing Patrick. Did you say we're eliminating the shuttle service? Okay.
I might have said it, but we are not.
We still have capital outlays for vans, so I think we've got shuttle service.
There's a reduction.
And does this budget include anything for the use of sky marshals and jets and those kinds of things like we have in the past? But how much of the services and supplies go to those kinds of things?
The vast majority of the services and supplies, we could share, go to the sky marshals, but I don't have the exact amount. If you like for this, the other services and supplies, we can break those out.
Marty, why don't you just go ahead, Marty?
Marty can provide that. Any other questions for me, Mr. Chair?
No other questions for you at this time. I just want to mention to the members of the committee, we've got... requests for the prioritized budget from general fund or general funds, general government budget dealing with general funds. Each of you have a copy, and I think I've received back Representative Johnson's this particular point of your prioritized.
Mr. Chair, you haven't, because it's still at my office right this second.
Oh, well, that was Senator Winters is what I've done. Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Winters. Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'll have mine back either on Tuesday or Wednesday, but I did have one question I would like to ask the presenter, and I don't know, we're probably going to have to start to establish a policy in here about whether we... is the House going into session at 10:30 also, or...
I think we're at 10:30.
Goes into session at 10:30 this morning, so about whether or not we want to get excused on a regular basis from session or whatever.
And we may just carry this over. We've got OPB tomorrow and Oregon Historical Society on Wednesday, but we could certainly carry over Marty's presentation for tomorrow morning at 8:30 if we're all here on time. So, Senator, please.
I did have a question, though, for Marty, and with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Please, go ahead.
It's a public safety question. In terms of, I see the average cost here for U.S. Marshal returns and some of the private transport returns. Do we have a standard, and who sets that standards in terms of at what level we stop seeking extradition?
We did. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marty Lynn Sackhoff. I'm the governor's general counsel, and I'm responsible for managing the extradition program on his behalf. Senator Devlin, we do have a policy established. It was put together originally. It was put together during the interim by a large coalition of law enforcement officers, including DAs, sheriffs, a lot of different people got together, established a policy. I can give you some of the factors of that policy, of what they look at when the DAs request for us to make an arrest and return. As you know, towards the end, after Measure 28 did not pass, some of the budget was taken back from extraditions. What we did at that time, if that's specifically what you're referring to, is decide even within that policy that we would request, given the amount of money we had left for the rest of this biennium, we requested that the DAs, before making their request to us, try to restrict those to Class A and B felonies only of a person-to-person crime.
Prior to that, it was lower on this?
Prior to that, there were a number of factors, 8 or 9 different factors, Class A and B felonies, but could have included other than person-to-person crime. The limitation we had imposed was to try to, in order to deal with the funds we had left, to try to elevate the request to what I call very, very egregious murders, assaults, things of that nature.
Chairman, just
please,
to follow,
please follow
up. If a DA, I'm trying to see, who has the ultimate say on extradition?
The DA's request, make a request to our office.
So your office has the ultimate say on whether...
Generally, although we work very cooperatively with them, and I don't think we have a lot of disagreement on that. I could ask our extradition officer to come up and give you more specific.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just one Hello. Final follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just get a copy of those standards?
Yes.
Representative Patridge is recognized.
Marty, there was an issue that was raised by Senator Minnis last session, and I don't know if you're aware of the issue because you're new to the position. The issue that was raised during the last regular legislative session was an issue regarding officer safety and the transport of these individuals. Was a policy decision reached as to, because before they would send one person to pick up a pretty dangerous offender, a lot of people didn't feel like that was the appropriate method to transport a prisoner, and so I'm just wondering what the upshot was from the interim discussion that occurred surrounding that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, they did create a policy that a two-officer return. If you'll, I'm not positive if you have the materials that I plan to pass out yet. Great. If you go to page 9, you'll see on that page performance measures, and you'll note that with the two-officer return policy, that U.S. Marshal returns are generally cheaper to do. The counties do have the ability in a particular case to decide whether or not a return actually warrants two officers, so there's still discretion for them to send one officer, but this is generally based on a two-officer return policy.
Okay, thank you.
And just for the record, I think that a lot of the local communities, especially if they feel it's an important arrest, will pick up the cost. Mm-hmm. Will pick up the cost of the officers who they send out of state, as opposed to burdening the cost of the state on that. So we appreciate local government's participation in stretching the state dollar a little further there.
President Johnson.
Thank you. Recently, and I know you know this, this building is just hums with unsubstantiated rumors, and one I'd like to try to get clarification on. Was there a recent instance where Oregon declined to go pick up a felon on the East Coast?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe you might be referring to a gentleman whose crime consisted of basically property crimes. Are you referring to the gentleman who committed a series of frauds against people within the state?
It was burglaries and frauds, I think, but I don't know. If it was just frauds, it's somewhere in New England.
Yes, we did.
The question that I'm trying to get to is that we're looking at a reclass here, and as I understand it from looking at the presentation materials, without having the benefit of your explanation, that the reclass is going to be funded by a shift from services service and supplies. And when you come back to make your full presentation, I'm trying to get a little bit of a handle on if we're declining to go pick folks up, where it involves at least what was described as fairly major criminal activities, and instead are putting that into salaries, when does the program lose its efficacy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the decline to get that person really had to do with the take back of funds in this last biennium. We were left with a minimum amount of funds, and in doing that, we had decided we would do shuttle returns only Class A, Class B felons of a person-to-person crime, a severe person-to-person crime. Generally, this budget, my understanding is as we're going forward, is we're not going to be limiting ourselves in that fashion going forward. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't necessarily decline an arrest and return, but with the budget, I'm assuming we won't be limited in the same way we've been limited in this last 4 months.
Thank you.
Senator
Winters. Mr. Chair, let's see if I understand this. The extradition officer actually works with the other states and works with the DA, and they're not the one that goes and picks up the individuals and bring them back to Oregon. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, that's correct.
Can you give me some kind of a history, and maybe the last three legislative sessions, biennium's, of the number of extraditions and some kind of trend line information of its decline or increase, and also information on how many are A and B's? What's the universe that we're talking about in extraditing people back to Oregon and generally the states where they're concentrated, if that's Washington or neighboring California, the other ones.
Put them on the show.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I don't have all of that information with me. I can get that information. You might want to look at page 9. It does give you total number of extraditions through December 31 in the last biennium.
Right. I would like just kind of see a history.
Okay.
And whether they're occurring mostly in our compact states.
And we participate with other states in that process of arrest and return to ship out of the state of Oregon. When Oregon declines to return one of its felons, do other states continue to participate in the process?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I know that one of the things that the subcommittee chairs have been particularly looking at is comparables with other states. And if you have any data from our surrounding states, comparable number of extraditions, comparable salary package, that would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'll get that information. I don't have it with me.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I think our colleagues have asked for things that we would all profit
yes,
from seeing.
Yes, if we could have make sure that those items are all funneled through Dallas, and then he'll provide them to the members of the committee, both House and Senate members. Okay, continue on. Marty, you jumped over to 9.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little bit confused. Did you want the presentation tomorrow morning, or do you want me to go ahead with it today?
Well, why don't we do this? We've lost our Senate at this particular point. They're back in session. So let's go ahead and carry over to tomorrow morning, and let's just have you wrap up at that particular point, if we could, Marty. With that, we'll go ahead and adjourn until tomorrow morning at evening time. Thank you.